UAB Medcast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB Medcast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
The burden of sepsis on our healthcare system is significant. And here to tell us about it today is Dr. Rachel Lee. She's in the Division of Infectious Diseases at UAB Medicine. And Dr. Blake Gibson. She's an associate professor and the assistant medical director, University Emergency Department at UAB Medicine. Ladies, thank you so much for being with us today. And sepsis, as I said in the intro, is pretty significant. Dr. Gibson, I'd like to start with you. Tell us about the current state of sepsis today. What's the prevalence and approximately how many people are affected by it each year?
So sepsis is extremely prevalent. It affects almost 2 million people each year in the United States. For those of you that are doing the math, that is like one case every 20 seconds. And the incidence is continuing to rise. It rises by about 8% each year. It's actually the leading cause of death in hospitals, and one in three patients who die in the hospital have sepsis in the United States. There are more than 270,000 people who die each year in this country. And actually, in 2017, sepsis was actually the ninth leading cause of death in the state of Alabama, and we rank third highest of all the states with sepsis cases.
Wow. I mean, those are incredible statistics, and it's something that can be pretty fatal and move very quickly. Dr. Lee, who is at risk for sepsis?
So most susceptible population is going to be children. Children die of sepsis, about 6,000 die a year, which is pretty high. Also, pregnant women have a higher risk of having sepsis, as well as patients who are immunocompromised. But anybody can get sepsis. If you get bacteria in your bloodstream, sometimes flu can cause sepsis, and so we're all at risk for it. The question is, what will happen to you after you develop sepsis?
Well, that's one of the most important things, is because of its rapid movement in some cases. Dr. Gibson, what are the systems that are most commonly affected? Tell us a little bit about how sepsis affects the body.
Sure. Well, when I am trying to explain to my patients what sepsis is, I will usually ask them, hey, what have you heard about sepsis? What do you think it is? And many of my patients tend to believe it's a bad infection or it's when the infection is in my bloodstream. But as physicians, we know this isn't necessarily the case. Sepsis is caused by an inflammatory immune response, which is triggered by an infection. Most commonly, the infection is bacterial, but it also may be fungal or viral or even protozoan.
So I would like to add that we classically think about it in terms of bacteria, because a lot of bacteria have different parts on them that can trigger a cytokine release. So for instance, gram-negative bacteria have lipopolysaccharide, and then that mediates the release of these cytokines and tumor necrosis factor, all of which activate this cascade that can cause bleeding and other sort of microvascular thrombosis.
Excellent description. Dr. Lee, what are some of your biggest challenges in diagnosing? What are some of the ways we can identify sepsis, Dr. Lee?
So we have some tools available to us in terms of diagnosing sepsis. So we have different scoring systems. We have something called a SIRS criteria, which stands for Systemic Inflammatory Response System. There's also the Q-SOFA score that was developed, but the issue with both of those is that many studies have found patients can fulfill two or more SIRS criteria in response to trauma, surgery, some sort of drug or transfusion reaction. Even severe pain can get you those criteria. And the Q-SOFA score was actually developed from an analysis of patients with suspected infection, so it was kind of a post-hoc analysis and really wasn't intended to be a rule-out tool. As Dr. Gibson will explain, every patient is different when they come to the ER, and so it can be quite difficult to actually identify those patients.
Dr. Gibson, give us some key recommendations for practice, for clinical practice guides for the management of sepsis. What do you do once you determine what's going on?
Well, I think CMS has provided actual sepsis guidelines that tell us exactly what they consider the diagnostic criteria for patients who are septic or have severe sepsis or considered to be septic shock. If we keep those diagnostic criteria in mind when treating patients, we can pretty easily make the diagnosis. I think selecting the most appropriate treatment plan is our primary concern at that point. And then secondary concerns are, as physicians, we should understand that CMS guidelines and documentation appropriately, choosing those appropriately, whether a patient has severe sepsis or septic shock, is also important. With all that being said, I really think the hardest part in diagnosing sepsis is exactly what Dr. Lee referred to. It's deciphering whether the patient's clinical status or SIRS criteria and lab values are secondary to sepsis or another medical process. So sometimes in the emergency department, it can be easy to develop tunnel vision when we have a patient who comes in with hypovolemia from, let's say, a GI bleed. And at that point, we begin resuscitating that patient, and we may forget, oh, wait a minute, they do meet some SIRS criteria, and could sepsis be playing a role here? And so that's what sometimes makes it difficult to initially pick up and pick up quickly. I imagine there are similar situations that arise in the inpatient care world that make this difficult as well.
Dr. Lee, speak about the treatment options. What does the antibiotic selection process look like, and how does that differ in the acute and less acute phases of treating it?
So for me, I tend to see these patients kind of on the back end after they've already had cultures that are growing a particular bacteria, so it's a lot easier for me to help with those antibiotic choices. It's a lot harder for these patients when they come into the emergency department to choose the appropriate antibiotic. The CMS guidelines do state to do broad-spectrum antibiotics, and as an infectious disease doctor, it's a little bit hard for me to say broad-spectrum antibiotics for every single patient that comes in. So, for instance, if I see a patient that is in the ER with pneumonia and they have a classic pneumonia, our drug choices are actually something like ceftriaxone and azithromycin, which is actually pretty narrow spectrum. There's a lot more data that shows that these broad-spectrum antibiotics can be dangerous. A randomized controlled trial showed no benefit in combination therapy versus monotherapy. And sometimes these can cause acute kidney injury. So we have to be careful with our broad spectrum choices. Now, if I have a patient that has septic shock and it's unclear what the source is, broad spectrum makes very much a lot of sense because we want to cover our bases in terms of what can cause that septic shock.
I would like to add to what Dr. Lee was saying. I agree with her. In the emergency department, we rarely have the luxury of knowing someone's culture data, and even sometimes are unable to identify a source of the infectious process. And for that reason, we intentionally begin with very broad-spectrum antibiotics. This occasionally, and maybe appropriately, causes the emergency department to be viewed as almost the vacant dozen czars of the hospital. But we do attempt to be as specific as possible with our antibiotic selection when we have an identified source or have recent culture data to assist us in the antibiotic selection process. As a matter of fact, I think many people hear CMS's recommendation of broad-spectrum antibiotics, and immediately they think the patient must have vancomycin. However, the approved list of CMS antibiotics actually has some very narrow choices. For example, Rocephin is an approved antibiotic. So even in the emergency department, without culture data, if we know the source of the infection is, for example, a UTI, we can administer Rocephin and still be considered CMS bundle compliant. If it would be helpful to the listeners, we could always place a link to the most recent CMS antibiotic list on the website and or potentially in the transcript, and they can go to that to be able to see this list of CMS compliant antibiotics.
That would be very helpful, Dr. Gibson, and we certainly will put that right on there for other providers to get that updated list, and thank you for offering that. So, Dr. Lee, sticking with you for just a minute, once it's been identified and completely treated, what does that de-escalation process look like? What's important for physicians and APPs to be aware of when they're documenting that particular case of sepsis?
So I'll give you kind of two examples. I believe de-escalation can be a little bit difficult. So if you have a patient that has a culture that's growing a very specific bacteria, narrowing your choice of antibiotics is actually pretty easy. especially if you know the source. So, for instance, they have a bone infection and they have cultures that are growing a very specific bacteria, you can narrow your choice pretty quickly. The harder question is actually for patients who present with an obvious case of sepsis. We have no microbiology data showing what the source is. In some of those cases, we can use kind of biomarkers such as procalcitonin that can help guide duration in therapy in patients with infection. But you really need at least two procalcitonins to be able to see kind of the trend line for those. The surviving sepsis guidelines recommend treating patients with sepsis or septic shock for 7 to 10 days of antibiotics. But recently in the ID world, there's been a lot of push to even making that shorter courses, which may be better. And that's just going to depend on your patient. And I tend to ask myself the following questions. Do we know the source of infection? If there's an abscess, has it been drained or do we have source control? Are there specific host factors that could cause reinfection, for instance, if you're immunocompromised? So it's really hard to create guidelines based on each patient. I think it's a lot easier upfront to say, yes, this patient has sepsis, and let's make sure that they're adequately hydrated and treat upfront, but it's a little bit harder to de-escalate.
And I would like to add to that, if I may, that if a patient has been appropriately treated for sepsis but may require additional treatment for another medical problem and is going to remain in the hospital, we should always remember to document that the sepsis diagnosis has been fully treated and remove it from the final diagnosis. It's also a good idea to place in the final diagnosis for this patient the word sepsis resolved. That helps, again, with documentation and for coders to understand that you believe you've completely treated sepsis. And then we should also be cognizant that many times we are appropriately mentioning sepsis in our differential diagnosis and in our medical decision making. However, once we are confident that we have ruled out sepsis, we should clearly state that fact in our documentation and place the phrase sepsis ruled out in the final diagnosis. Again, this is helpful for our coders, and it's helpful in making sure that our mortality index is not negatively impacted by poor documentation.
What a great point, Dr. Gibson. So first, last word to you. Give us the horizon picture, a blueprint for future therapies. What do you see happening in the sepsis world?
Well, for now, the mainstay in treating sepsis is really early antibiotics and fluids when appropriate. There has been, and unless you've been living under a rock, some recent excitement over the use of vitamin C in the treatment of patients with severe sepsis and septic shock. But we're not really sure what to make of that case. Really, all that work is coming from Dr. Paul Merrick. He's a well-known critical care physician and professor of medicine from Eastern Virginia School of Medicine. He published a paper in which suggested that a therapeutic cocktail of vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine is an effective treatment in preventing organ dysfunction and reducing mortality in patients with severe sepsis and septic shock. The overwhelming feeling amongst my colleagues, at least, and I believe this is probably true for most intensivists and emergency physicians, is that this study did in fact show that vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine showed an association with lower mortality, but causation has yet to be demonstrated. And Dr. Merrick himself referred to his findings as preliminary and encouraged confirmatory studies. So while there are several studies in the works, one was published recently in Critical Care Medicine as recent as February. And this study showed that the use of vitamin C in a mixed ICU population did not appear to reduce mortality or improve other important outcomes. So for now, I don't know anyone who is using this cocktail to treat severe sepsis and septic shock, but I know a lot of people, myself included, who are anxiously awaiting the remaining studies to be published.
Dr. Lee, last word to you. What would you like other providers to take away from this segment that's such important information about sepsis? Please tell us your final words or final thoughts on this.
You know, I think it's pretty easy to recognize sepsis in the ER. The ER has a great program for identifying that. It's a lot harder for patients that are critically ill and been on the floor in the hospital to diagnose that. So what I would recommend for our providers is to have a heightened suspicion for sepsis in your patients that may have fever or leukocytosis and to really think through your antibiotic choices when dealing with those patients because they may already be chronically infected in some way or have antibiotics already on board for another infection, and it is possible that those patients can become infected again.
It's great information, doctors. Thank you so much for joining us today, for sharing your expertise and the link that you'll provide on guidelines for antibiotic use. So thank you again for being with us. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for tuning in.